South Central Alaska has seen an extreme mix of winter weather so far this snow season, and in some of the most popular mountain areas for Alaskans to get out and enjoy fresh snow, avalanche danger is high in the Alaskan backcountry. Before you grab your skis, splitboard, or load up the snow machine, stay with us for Talk of Alaska to hear from avalanche experts and guides about how best to prepare and what to watch for when venturing out into the mountains.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
In rural Alaska communities, village public safety officers make a difference every day. Hired regionally, VPSOs are trained in public safety services such as community policing, fire prevention, life-saving emergency medical response, and search and rescue. VPSO receive competitive pay, benefits, and opportunities for advancement. To start your career in public safety and learn more about becoming a VPSO, go to vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by VPSO.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. On Friday afternoon, the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center sent out a special bulletin saying avalanche danger is considerable for the Turnagain Pass, Kenai, and Western Chugach Mountains. High winds today will continue the trend of problematic avalanche conditions. So what do South Central residents and visitors need to know about where it is and is not safe to get out and enjoy fresh snow, and how forecasts can change? Here to help us better understand the snow conditions is Elliot Gaddy. Elliot is a guide and avalanche safety trainer, and John Sykes is a forecaster with the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to have you both in the studio. You two can join the discussion, Alaskans. Are you eager to get out into all that snow, but aren't sure where it's safe? Have you experienced an avalanche and want people to know how dangerous it can be to trigger one? You can join the conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, John, start us off here. How unusual was the bulletin that got sent out? And I saw that it went out on Friday afternoon, but you were asking for media to make that announcement by 6 a.m. Saturday morning. Was it unusual? And why was it only in effect until Sunday at 6?
Yeah, so the special avalanche bulletin that we issued on Saturday is kind of a public communications tool that we use when conditions are not necessarily, there's not like a big storm going on that would cause natural avalanches to just release spontaneously. It's more a specific set of conditions that we think is really likely for human-triggered avalanches. And that's what we had this weekend with we had a layer, what we call a persistent weak layer. So this basically means if you trigger it, you could produce a really large avalanche. So we wanted people to be a little bit extra cautious. And it seemed appropriate. We ended up having, I think, 3 or 4 human-triggered avalanches this weekend, none of which nobody was buried or injured, as far as we know, just close calls. So.
Sounds really scary. Even the close calls, I'm sure, are really, really frightening. Give us an overview of, John, of current conditions in the areas where people like to go. Hatcher Pass, Turnagain area, like Tin Can, Corn Biscuit, Eddies. There is a red, I was looking this morning, there's this red level 4 area in Turnagain where very dangerous avalanche conditions exist and travel's not recommended. Looks like a place to just stay away from right now.
Yeah, that when we issue a high danger rating, so that's the scale goes from low to extreme. It's a 5-level scale. And so, yeah, like you said, high danger is level 4 out of 5. And in those conditions, we basically recommend people avoid avalanche terrain and any slopes that are underneath avalanche terrain because we have really strong winds going on today and a lot of soft snow on the surface. So the potential for snow to be taken from a ridge line and redistributed by the wind onto another area and then produce natural avalanches is pretty likely. Mm. Yeah. So that's kind of The potential for natural avalanches is the biggest driver for when we have high danger. And then, like you said, over the weekend or on Saturday when we had that special avalanche bulletin, it's more of an awareness of human-triggered avalanches. So that's some of the difference there between considerable and high avalanche danger.
Do you ever have an opportunity to talk to folks who have either been partially carried or buried and have survived an avalanche about why they were where they were, if they just didn't see the warning or what do people say?
You know, a lot of times it comes down to what we call the human factor in avalanche education, which is more about individual decision-making processes and kind of what factors are driving someone's decision. And they're not always just risk-based. They're not always just thinking about what are the weak layers, what's the likelihood of triggering. It's more like, well, the snow conditions are really good and there's a few other people going up that skin track, so maybe it's okay. You know, maybe the avalanche forecast overestimated the conditions, which of course does happen. But often when we interview people, we try and make an effort to talk to everyone that sends us an observation and get a little bit of insight from what they were seeing in the field, especially when it's a close call or a near miss avalanche accident. We'll often call them and kind of get a little bit more of their perspective. So yeah, it's hard. It's there's a lot of different factors that you kind of have to keep in your head for decision making in avalanche terrain, and it's easy to get derailed because of it's really good ski conditions or you saw other people traveling in that area, so you kind of assume it's safe. But especially with these conditions we've had the last couple weeks, just because other people have already traveled on the slope doesn't necessarily mean it's safe. You can actually trigger an avalanche where people have already skied if you're the one who kind of touches that sweet spot.
Yikes. I don't know that I would call it a sweet spot, but
yeah.
the area of concern. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about avalanche safety in South Central Alaska, and maybe we'll get to a few questions about other areas of the state. I know that our guests today are experts in the local area in South Central, but probably know a little bit about what conditions are like in other areas as well. Elliot Gaddy is in the studio with us. He is a guide and avalanche safety instructor. And John Sykes is also here with us. John is a forecaster with the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Elliot, I want to get you in here now. You're a guide, as I said, an avalanche instructor. What type of conditions have you been seeing this year when you're taking people out, and how do you have to adjust then based on how extreme the risk is or isn't in some places?
Well, we've seen a variety of conditions. We start working avalanche courses in late November, so it was a little bit of a slow start in terms of coverage. The snow has continued to fall, thankfully, and we're getting a little bit more of a snowpack, but most of our operations happen in either Chugach State Park or Turnagain Pass. I think we've had like 2 or 3 days up in Hatcher so far this year. So we've been managing this persistent weak layer that we have right now, the buried surface ore, and then there's some deeper instabilities that we're also managing. So it's really been a matter of choosing terrain that's appropriate for the conditions, which for the most part has been staying on lower angles below 30 degrees. And there's still a lot of fun and educational opportunities we had in those spots. So it's worked really well for us. We get a lot of good days in the middle of winter, but really the prime time is for Alaska skiing, I think, is like mid-February to late April, early May. So we're just in the holding pattern until some of these things stabilize out and step out into bigger terrain, if it's appropriate after that.
And when you're out in areas below the 30-degree level, are you stopping and talking with the people that you're guiding about what's happening up above there? I mean, are you showing them areas where, okay, that area looks incredibly dicey right now and it's a good thing that we're down here? Or do you talk about how to read snow when you're out there?
Oh yeah. The the baseline, you know, most of our courses are recreational level one avalanche courses, and we're trying to get the basics of terrain identification, which is really the baseline for, like, you know, whether avalanches are going to happen or not in that terrain. And then, you know, what conditions we're seeing in the field, how those affect that, the terrain that we're getting into. It's a really complex environment, and we try to point out as much as we can, but there's things that we don't even know what's going on in the snow, and we try to make sure people understand that we can't see everything that's happening.
And I realize that Anchorage is at a much lower elevation than where you're taking people, but it warmed up dramatically overnight, you know, from in the low 20s to it was 40 for a little bit this morning, and now the last time I checked it was 38. How can temperature changes like that that are kind of rapid affect conditions, and how quickly can that make things that maybe were safe suddenly not safe?
Yeah, rapid temperature increase is, there's a direct correlation to instability, especially the closer you are to freezing. So anytime we see a rapid warm-up, we're generally assuming that in the short term we're going to have some increase in instability. We're getting into 40 degrees here. I didn't even look at Center Ridge this morning up in Turnigan Pass, but I don't know if that was above freezing or not.
I don't know either.
Yeah.
So John, back to you. Thanks, Elliot. John, back to you. What do you and your team do to determine the danger rating each day? What are you looking at?
We're looking at a variety of things. We try to do field days several days a week. So we get in the mountains, digging snow pits, and evaluating weak layers on our own, doing our own tests and data collection. So that's a big part of it. We also rely heavily on public observations, so people who are getting out there to areas that we can't go or don't have time to go, contributing to the decision-making process. And then we look at, we have a network of remote weather stations in the mountains, so some of them are up high on ridge lines to give us information on wind speeds. Some of them are a little lower elevation protected areas to give us more accurate information on snowfall totals. So there's a bunch of these resources that are available on our website, and we rely on those heavily. And then the last big component is the weather forecast for the next day. So we try and basically spend the first chunk of our day forecasting, getting a sense of like, okay, what are the conditions up till now? And then we switch to what are they going to be for the next 24 hours? So our forecast products are 24-hour. They're valid for 24 hours. So we're really looking at relatively short-term weather forecasts, things like wind speeds, temperature, and snowfall or rain totals that'll make the snowpack more or less unstable than it is, you know, when we're getting up early, right in the forecast.
So people should be checking every single day, not looking at the beginning of the week and thinking, okay, I'm good to go on Friday.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I used to teach avalanche classes for a long time, and one of the best kind of continuing education practices that I've recommended to people is to just read the forecast, because, you know, that information that you get, say you took a rec level one with Elliot 2 years ago, but you've only been in the backcountry 5 or 10 days since then, you know, that information starts to get hazier and hazier the longer out since you've taken it. And if you continue reading the forecast, you're at least getting, might not be getting the hands-on practice of being in the field, but you're at least kind of staying refreshed with the terminology and kind of the range of different conditions that can happen. So I think it's a great way to just stay a little more in touch with what's going on in the mountains if you're hoping to get out there at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Elliot, last week an avalanche near Girdwood hit the train tracks overnight. The train couldn't stop in time, plowed into the debris. Fortunately and fantastically, no one was injured, which when you look at those pictures, just wow. How surprised were you by that avalanche, and did it sort of make sense given the current conditions?
If terrain is steep enough to slide and there's snow on that terrain, then we have to keep in our minds that there's the potential to have avalanches. But it's really hard to predict if that's going to happen. And, you know, the winds were blowing hard that night. There was snowfall. I didn't pay attention to that exact incident enough to know, like, if they had had any information beforehand, but I'm sure if they had it, you know, they would not have had a train crash into that cell.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty dramatic.
John. Yeah. I think in that particular storm, it was, they were predicting way less snowfall. So I think it was like double the snowfall they were predicting. And so anytime you have that kind of rapid loading, you know, a foot of snow falling on top of a weak layer, your avalanches are more likely. So it's kind of a different, type of forecasting when you're looking at for the railroad or for the highway, where they have, they know all the avalanche paths that have the potential to hit the railroad or the highway or the power lines. They all have avalanche kind of departments. And so they're monitoring those and looking at how much snow is filling in the terrain features. And so when you have an unexpected weather event like that, it can potentially catch folks off guard, because, you know, you're basing your decisions on the current conditions plus the weather in the future. And if that weather goes way off the rails of what you're expecting, then you can have a kind of unexpected events like that. And we had one last year also that hit the highway on just north of Girdwood. A big avalanche came down and hit the highway, and it was a really similar thing. It was a short, intense burst of snowfall, but not a huge amount. You know, in Alaska, we're used to getting feet of snow. And these events were not that much snow, so it's a little surprising that suddenly you go from no avalanches to producing really large avalanches really quickly. It can be very challenging to predict in time very accurately like that.
Yeah. And if you think about the amount of uncertainty that we have with predicting avalanches, and the amount of infrastructure within the whole state that is exposed to avalanche hazard, it's a pretty good job that everybody's doing in terms of keeping folks safe.
Well, that's good to hear. Although, based on your comments, John, even though you have been doing this for a long time, you're well versed in what snow conditions are and should look like if it's safe, things can change and surprise you, clearly.
Yeah, uncertainty is a huge part of the equation. Whether you're forecasting or traveling in the mountains, you're never going to know all the conditions everywhere you're going. And so part of the complication is what we call spatial variability. It's kind of just a fancy term for the snowpack is going to look different on one side of the mountain versus on the other side. And things like wind and changes in snow depth have a really big role to play in that. And so your ability to assume what the conditions are somewhere else based on digging a snow pit in one location, it's really, really challenging. So a lot of it is kind of forming a mental model in our heads of what the snowpack looks and doing our best to update it as we get more information.
Well, we're going to talk more about that in a minute. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to join our conversation today. 1-800-478-8255. In the Anchorage area, the local number is 907-550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go to the phones. Anita is in Anchorage, but has experienced an avalanche in Unalaska. Hello, Anita.
Hi. In 1989, we had a very cold snap in the state, and we had several feet of this fluffy, beautiful white snow. And it was quite cold, and up above the land that we built our house on, we built into the hillside because it was steep. And up at the top above our house were these beautiful pillows of snow that I admired when I drove home. And during the night while we were asleep, the temperature went up and we got several, it just started snowing, this very wet snow. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, an avalanche cut loose up above our house and came down and put 12 feet of snow on the top of the house. And fortunately, it only knocked the wall in due to the fact that we were built into the hillside and there was a lot of snow already. And just like we always get a lot of earthquakes out there, but an avalanche is as loud as an earthquake, but there's no movement. And it took me a minute to figure out what was happening, but yeah, Doug Fessler came out and observed the avalanche to give us some information on how to avoid it in the future. But fortunately, the land up above us was developed, so people were plowing the road up there, so there wasn't any more snow buildup. But it was quite exciting.
Yeah. Well, I'm so happy that you're still here to tell us the story, because it sounds exciting but also terrifying. Wow, 12 feet of snow, that's incredible.
Yes, and the Department of Public Safety estimated it was 40 pounds per square foot. So we were able to round up a couple guys to come and shovel our roof off because we were worried about it collapsing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was... And you know, who would have thought that this would be happening out in the Aleutians on a little... It's the hillside was only a couple hundred feet high. So you just never know where they're going to occur.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Anita, for the call, and so glad that you're okay. John, did you
just ask something? Yeah, well, thanks for sharing. I think that... there's actually been a handful of avalanche accidents in Alaska that I'm aware of that were on relatively smaller terrain features. You know, we live in a state covered with huge mountains, but when we get snow, especially a really rapid snow load, so like overnight, like she was describing, you can have avalanches on relatively small terrain features. So like just the cut bank of a creek or something like that. There's been several snow machine accidents where people were riding in relatively tame terrain, but... You know, there was an unstable snowpack on a river cut bank and an avalanche released, and you can get caught in that. So I think it's, you know, it's easy to think about avalanches coming off these giant mountains and coming down into the terrain. But when you do have unusual conditions like that, they can happen on relatively benign terrain features as well, as long as it's above 30 degrees.
People need to be aware and watching and know what they're looking for. Elliot, how do you determine if and when it's safe to take clients into the backcountry? Is there almost always an option, or sometimes you just have to call trips off?
Well, for the first part of that question, what we use to determine if there is going to be safe avalanche conditions to get in the field, we're using information from the websites like Hatcher Pass Avalanche Center and Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. And we're using that, and then we're combining that with the information that we have from our observations in the field. You know, what's going on in the snowpack, where are the good conditions? And we can make some relatively good decisions about stability and, you know, decide what terrain is going to be appropriate for the day. That does require us to sometimes move into different locations than when we usually operate at. Luckily, we have a lot of different mountain ranges really close to Anchorage. So I don't think I've ever called off something because the AVI conditions were so bad. We just go to places where we're not going to cause avalanches. For instance, Sunday, where there was a pretty significant avalanche hazard, we stayed to lower angle terrain on Center Ridge in Turnagain Pass, which does have a few small slopes that could cause avalanches, but we get pretty wide margins so we can stay away from those things. And go out and you learn about avalanches by being out in those conditions, just giving the dangerous places a real wide margin.
Mm-hmm. How often are you going out, and who are you taking out into these areas? Is it mainly Alaskans, or is it mainly visitors from outside?
We have a good combination of Alaskans and visitors from outside. You know, more, I would say, middle of the winter, like dead of winter, it's mostly Alaskans that are taking our avalanche courses. Those opportunities exist for people from other places in their local areas. If they want to be in the mountains, it's not that easy to get to Alaska. But once we start hitting like mid-February on, we get a lot more people from out of state. You know, temperatures get nicer, days get longer, we get a little fatter snowpack. And that's what, you know, there's a reason why Alaska is in almost every major ski film. It's like the conditions are just so good around here.
Or at least they say it's Alaska. It might be actually British Columbia.
Just a snowy mountain. You can call it anything.
So, John, there's so many areas, you know, Elliot was just talking about that there's a lot of great mountain ranges within driving distance of Anchorage where people can get out and recreate in so many areas in the backcountry. How do you decide which areas to issue avalanche forecasts for?
Well, our forecast is a predefined area. So it extends through Girdwood is kind of the northern part. And then the Placer and 20 Mile Rivers kind of near Portage are included, and Turnagain Pass. So it's a relatively small area given how many, how much mountainous terrain there is around. And that's, for us, that's determined by the boundaries of the Chugach National Forest up against the Chugach State Park. So it just does kind of come down to a land management situation for as far as where our forecast is valid. We do occasionally do further south on the Kenai Peninsula, like Summit Lake area near Moose Pass is also a really popular area that people go to. So we try and go there every couple weeks and kind of check in on the conditions, and we'll do what we call observations. So it's not a forecast, but we'll post it on our website publicly. And oftentimes we'll post a video of like, oh, here's what we're seeing in the snowpack. Here are the weak layers to look out for. So it's kind of our effort to provide information from a broader swath of terrain without necessarily forecasting for that area. Because to actually provide a forecast, you need kind of a continuous data collection and continuous observations to really have an intimate knowledge of the snowpack. And yeah, it mostly comes down to kind of resources for developing that. I work on a team of three forecasters, and so we kind of trade off days of writing the forecasts and going in the field to collect information. And yeah, we just basically need more forecasters around to get information from the Chugach Front Range around Anchorage. And Hatcher Pass also has an avalanche center, the Hatcher Pass Avalanche Center. They're a volunteer-based program developed by Jed Workman and Allie Barker, and they've grown over the past several years and get a lot of support from the community, which is awesome. And so their forecast region is right around kind of Independence Mine and the Archangel area, kind of the high use recreation areas in Hatcher Pass. But outside of that, I would say the other forecasts in Alaska are all based on where there's the most use. So Valdez, there's an avalanche forecast there. Haines also has an avalanche center. There's an avalanche center based out of Juneau, I think, the Coastal Alaska Avalanche Center. So there are other resources available, but depending on the funding and the kind of size of the center, they'll maybe only issue them on the weekends or maybe 3 or 4 days a week. It just kind of depends on what resources people have available.
How about for interior?
There is the Eastern Alaska Avalanche Center that's kind of in the Paxson area, like near Black Rapids, which I think is a lot of use out of Fairbanks. People driving south from Fairbanks to recreate there. I don't know the details there because I don't get out there very often.
I think that's just observer comments as opposed to a forecast, but with valuable information for sure.
Yeah. And that's actually how our center started. There was a big avalanche in, I think it was in 2001. That several snow machiners were killed in Turnagain Pass, and that was the impetus to start our avalanche center. And it started off as just an observation page. So somewhere to a central repository to collect information, both from avalanche professionals and the community. And it's a really good starting point for developing avalanche center.
Yeah, absolutely. When the Chugach page says avalanche danger is high above 2,500 feet, what does that mean for people who want to go backcountry skiing or snow machining?
I would recommend not going above 2,500 feet.
Okay, so just stay low and stay out of those areas.
Yeah, there are often very big differences with elevation. So like you just mentioned, the temperature went up to 40 degrees. So that means the rain-snow line probably went up. And so it's going to be raining up higher than it was the last several days. So one of the things that makes it challenging keeping a finger on the pulse of the conditions is that it's always changing with elevation and aspect. And so on days like this, you could probably go, well, you can always choose mellow terrain and even go up into higher elevations as long as you're very conscious of your terrain. But the avalanche danger can change quite a bit with our different elevation bands. And like down low, it's the last few storms we've had have been mostly rain below 1,000 feet. So the avalanche conditions are actually pretty not interesting down low. It's mostly just rain on snow. Kind of feels like a spring snowpack.
Those sound like perfect conditions to me. Not interesting. I that's where I want to be, is the not interesting areas.
Yeah.
Where it's safe and maybe a little boring, but you're safe.
Maybe a little damp.
We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about avalanche safety in Alaska with our experts, Elliot Gaddy and John Sykes, as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's time to apply for a Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Award. Deadline is March 1st. If you've tried before, maybe this year will be your year. Many artists apply multiple times before getting the grant. Use the grant to explore, honor elders and mentors, and contribute to the vibrancy of Alaska communities. The foundation offers workshops to help artists, makers, and culture bearers. More at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by Rasmussen.org, promoting a better life for all Alaskans.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing avalanche safety as Alaska sees a lot of snow, and we want to make sure that people can safely get out and have a lot of fun, but be safe in these high-risk areas. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to call in with questions or comments about avalanche safety. 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the local number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email questions or comments to talk@alaskapublic.org. If people venture into areas where there are no forecasts, what do they need to really be aware of and what should they be watching for? Elliot?
Well, you know, paying attention to what the weather's been doing for as far out as you can reasonably pay attention to. You know, if I'm going to be going to an area that I don't have a ton of information, I'll be looking at the weather systems like, you know, 2 weeks, 10 days out. There's, you know, if you've got some friends that have been out in those areas, sometimes you got to do a little bit of legwork to find folks that have traveled in those zones. The more personal network you have of outdoor enthusiasts, the better. But, you know, there's a lot of places where we just don't have much information. And in situations like that, you have to take a really conservative approach, give yourself a lot of options. If you're going to go to a zone to explore, make sure that every single option for you isn't like a 4,000 foot peak that's, you know, 45 degrees on all aspects. So, you know, it's like you get out, you know, if you're flying in somewhere or something like that, you get out of the plane, set up, start digging in the snow, do some mellow touring outside of avalanche terrain to get some idea what the snowpack's doing, make some observations about, you know, some sort of general trend in the area. And then, you know, once you get a little bit more comfort with the zone, then you can start to maybe step out a little bit. But we just have to take it slow, as opposed to when we just don't have that much information. You don't want to just get out there and go wild.
Well, and John, did you want to add that?
Yeah, I guess I would add, for folks that are interested in like flying into the big mountain ranges, like the Alaska Range or the Chugach, kind of doing these bigger spring expeditions, the avalanche conditions in the springtime tend to be much more predictable. Oftentimes, once we get enough sun and heat on the snowpack, it develops kind of a crust layer on the surface that will melt and then freeze every day as the sun comes out and the temperatures warm up. So sometimes if you're looking to get into bigger mountains and kind of more consequential terrain, waiting until the spring where we have a thicker snowpack that follows a little more of that predictable cycle can be a good time to do it. And I think with Elliot and the guys that he guides with, like oftentimes in the springtime is when you'll do your bigger trips, because you can, some of that uncertainty gets minimized a little when we have a really thick snowpack and we have those kind of springtime melt freeze conditions.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about gear and classes, but let's first go back to the phones for a moment. Ethel is in Sterling. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Did you have a question?
I did. Earlier in the hour, you referenced something about a weak foundational layer that starts out unstable, and then the impact that that heavy snowfall and heavy wet snowfall has on that layer. And the reason I'm asking about that instability is because I live in the western Kenai Peninsula. And for those of us who have to drive back and forth for medical appointments to Anchorage, avalanches are a huge matter of concern. And so I'm like, okay, do I schedule this for this for that, or is it safer to fly from Kenai to Anchorage or what? But I was really curious because there are a number of us who have to drive back and forth, and we're not, like, I'm 67. I'm not going to go backcountry or anything like that. And I see snow machiners and skiers, and I envy them. But I'm mostly curious about the technical aspects about what you touched on earlier about some weak foundational layer and the impact of weather and damp snow and blowing snow we deal with anyway, but the weight and the different accumulations thereof, it's just mostly something to satisfy a niggling question in the back of my mind.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you called, Ethel, because I also wondered, and John or Elliot, I'm not sure if you have much information about this, but I wonder, when does the Department of Transportation decide to do avalanche mitigation along the highways where we know that can happen? So, John, do you have any information about that for Ethel?
The timing of when they call it avalanche control work, so they actually use like big World War II howitzers to mm-hmm. shoot avalanche paths with big bombs, basically. And so some of those deeper weak layers might not exist in those avalanche paths that threaten the highway because they've done avalanche mitigation previously. So mm-hmm. we think about, like, when we're doing a forecast for the backcountry, we're thinking about a snowpack that is natural and doesn't have any kind of avalanche mitigation to change the snowpack structure. And when you're talking about paths along the highway or like at Alyeska at a ski area, they do so much avalanche control work there that they develop a different snowpack. And so oftentimes those deeper weak layers are not as much of a concern because they don't have snow on top of them because they've done avalanche control previously and brought down most of the snowpack on top of the weak layers. So it's really, they don't have a fixed schedule for when they do that type of work. They base it on the weather conditions. And I have a lot of faith in the guys who do the Department of Transportation and the railroad. Like, I don't particularly worry when I'm driving on the highway that I'm going to get hit by an avalanche because, you know, they have a full-time professional crew that tracks those things. I think the bigger hazard is road conditions. You know, whenever you have mm-hmm. that kind of blowing snow and heavy snowfall on the road where it's making for challenging driving, the conditions are the same up in the avalanche paths. So I would just, if you can avoid driving during heavy snowfall and wind, that's the most likely time where you're going to see avalanche activity.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ethel, thank you for the call, expressing a practical concern about, you know, being on the road and worrying about that drive. So it sounds like DOT has it locked down, and that's good that they're watching that thing. So hopefully, Ethel, that'll give you a little more confidence. Let's stay with the phones for a moment. Bob is in Anchorage, and it looks like he's going to kind of queue up where I wanted to go next, which is gear and training. So hi, Bob.
Good morning. Great show. Good job from all three of you. Safety prevention, of course, but if somebody does get buried, the statistics still seem to be pretty grim on the length of time to dig them out and have them survive. Are there any recent developments in technology, either probes or beacons that assist in getting somebody out sooner? And what about avalanche bags? Have they been out long enough to say very much about whether they improve safety or not, or do they just make people take higher risks? Thank you.
And please explain, I have no idea what an avalanche bag is.
Oh, yeah. Well, the three baseline pieces of equipment that we've used for a long time for avalanche safety are a beacon, a probe, and a shovel. The probe and the shovel have not changed that much in recent times. Avalanche beacons keep getting better and better. There's limitations to the effectiveness of any of this equipment. Yeah, we're looking at a 10 to 15 minute time frame that we want to get somebody out of the snow and have an acceptable rate of survivability. You know, it doesn't help if they've been, if they've had a bunch of trauma on the way down. That can be, when the snow stops moving, fatalities could have already happened.
Maybe, do you mind just real quick before you go to airbags? The beacon, basically, for those who don't know, it's like a computer that you wear on your chest that transmits a signal. And so if Elliot and I are out together, we're both wearing beacons. We have them in transmit mode most of the time, sending out a signal. And then if one of us gets buried, the other partner will turn their beacon into search mode. So then I'll pick up the signal. So if I'm within, it's like roughly 50 meters or so of Elliot and he's buried, my beacon will take me. It takes practice to use them effectively, but it takes you right to the spot where they are, and then you use the probe to figure out the exact depth and location. Mm-hmm. So just to give people a general overview.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
So we're all carrying that stuff in the field. The airbags are a piece of equipment that has recently become a much more widespread way to reduce our vulnerability. And it's just a part of the backpack that it's an airbag, and it expands when you pull a rip cord on your shoulder strap. There's various ways to deploy that, gas systems or fans, but what it does is just make you a bigger object in the snow, and that will help to bring you to the surface. And there is definitely I think it's about I don't really remember the statistics on this, but it's undoubtable that airbags, if deployed when you're in an avalanche, provide a better survivability rate.
So I'm trying to vision what this looks like. It's just a bag that's going to blow up and be like around your shoulders?
Yeah, it's like behind your head, around your shoulders, and it looks like an airbag in a car. When you pull that ripcord, it expands, and it only takes like a matter of seconds for that thing to blow up. It keeps you up towards the top rather than letting you get buried down, down lower in the snow. There's very few downsides to airbags. They're a little bit heavier, a little more expensive, but given the safety that, improves with airbags, there's more and more people that are wearing them. And I think that, you know, who knows, maybe in 5 years that it'll be something that pretty much everybody has in their packs. I don't know if you guys do any idea about how many people are wearing them these days.
I would say less than half, probably.
Yeah, I'd probably say something like that, too.
So that's probably the biggest change or advancement in safety gear, would you say?
Yeah, and there's this whole argument of risk homeostasis, where people get a little bit more safety equipment and then they're willing to push the limits a little bit more. So that's another subjective element involved with whenever you include safety equipment. But it's hard to argue. I put my seatbelt on when I get in the car.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. All right. We're going to take another short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about what you need to know before you head out into Alaska's backcountry to stay safe as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Following up on being safe, I remember hearing in the past, I don't know if it's true or if it's one of those things that you just hear about, if you're in an avalanche, you should try to swim to get to the surface or stay on top of the snow or something. But when I think about that, it sounds like it doesn't sound practical, because I would imagine the snow is incredibly heavy and full of huge chunks, and there might be other debris in there. So is that really true? Should you try to do that, or are you just tucking in and trying to keep all your arms and legs?
Well, keeping all your arms and legs is definitely a good idea. I think the basic recommendation is you want to be buried as shallowly as possible. Your chance of surviving is much higher if you're closer to the surface when the avalanche stops. Mm-hmm. And there's really a wide range of conditions. Like, some avalanches are very hard and they break into big blocks and it's like traveling downhill with a bunch of big boulders. And some of them are very soft and it's, you know, like soft powder snow, and it would be more similar to traveling downhill in the water or something like that. So there's a wide range of like what the experience can be if you're actually caught in an avalanche. But in general, just trying to get out of the main flow of debris is your biggest goal. So if you realize you're in an avalanche, the first thing you might want to do is, if you have some awareness of how wide that avalanche propagated or where the kind of edges are, if you can get to an edge and get out of the flowing debris, or stop yourself on the bed surface, a rest on the bed surface, we call it, then you're not going to be caught in the debris flow. So then your chances of surviving are much higher. If you are caught up in that, people recommend using a technique like rolling. You can kind of like do a body roll towards the edge of the avalanche to move yourself kind of across that debris column. I think about it kind of like white water, like being in a river. You're kind of being pulled downriver. And if you're not going to necessarily be able to like swim directly across the current, but if you can kind of make some effort to move across the current and kind of ferry yourself over towards the edge of the avalanche, then that can be an advantage. Yeah, and so swimming kind of comes into the same, you know, trying to just keep yourself up higher in the debris column or get off to the sides of the moving avalanche all could decrease your burial depth. And the shallower that you're buried, the better chance that your partners will come and rescue you.
Because I imagine once the snow stops, depending on what type of snow it is, it could be really hard to move.
Yeah, I've never had that experience of being fully or even kind of partially buried, but all the accounts that you read is that it sets up like concrete and you basically can't move at all. You're even like moving your fingers or taking a deep breath becomes really challenging.
So terrifying.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you've not been partially buried, but have you experienced avalanches yourselves, Elliot and John, either individually or as part of a group?
Yeah, the reality is, the more time you spend in avalanche terrain, and the closer you get to that terrain, the more, you know, just by sheer value of like the amount of exposure you have, you're inevitably going to be involved with some avalanches. And in a small controlled sense, we try to look for small slopes that we can kick around on and set off avalanches from. Safe places, either to you know, just get an idea what's happening in the snowpack. But yeah, I mean, I'd be lying if I said I never had any time where I wasn't hit by some snow or caused an avalanche when I was on the slab. It's all been relatively small things, and a lot of those experiences were earlier in my career where I won't even say career part of it. It's like the recreational standpoint where you live through some early experiences, especially, you know, in my early stages, being a male in my early 20s, you can make a lot of bad decisions, and hopefully you learn from those things and
live through
still,
them.
Yeah, I'm still here right now.
Yeah, thank goodness. John, your experience in that regard.
Really similar experience, Elliot. We have kind of a similar background. We used to be mountaineering guides together in Talkeetna, but the biggest experience that I had was on a trip that I did on Mount Logan with a group of friends. It wasn't a work trip, it was just a personal trip, but we triggered a pretty large avalanche in a piece of terrain that had a lot of exposure, and two of my friends that I was on this trip with got caught and carried down the east ridge of Mount Logan right on the kind of first part of the climb. And so it's a huge reality check, you know. One of my friends was fully buried, and luckily he was able to kind of stick his arm out at the very last second, and he was able to reach to the surface. So he had a pathway for air to get to the surface to him. And we were able to dig him out fairly quickly. But, you know, you don't have to have a lot of close calls like that to realize that the risk is high, and it switches from being a kind of a fun adventure to like, why are we doing this kind of mindset? And I think having those adventures, those experiences early on helped reinforce just avoiding avalanche terrain when the conditions aren't right, and being very selective of when you're going to expose yourself to steeper slopes and more consequential terrain, because, you know, it's more tangible that the consequences can be really severe.
Mm-hmm. One person was caught and carried in an avalanche in Turnagain in early January. What happened in that incident, and why was it considered a near miss?
That incident was on Corn Biscuit, which is one of the popular trailheads on the skier side of Turnagain Pass. And it was kind of a unique incident because the weak layer that we were dealing with at that time, which is still there but has been less reactive since, was really deeply buried. So it was actually, this weak layer formed around Thanksgiving, where we had a warm storm with that created an ice crust, and then over time a weak layer of facets developed on top of that ice crust. And so, long story short, we had a weak layer that had the potential to create very large avalanches. So that avalanche, I think, was like varied from 3 to 6 feet deep, and the individual that triggered it, there was already, I think, 5 ski tracks on the slope when they triggered that avalanche. And so all those ski tracks got taken out by the avalanche, and it actually propagated across the whole slope and triggered another avalanche on the other aspect of that mountain. So it's pretty remarkable, what we call propagation, but essentially you're triggering an avalanche in one spot and basically collapse the entire mountainside. That's not that common. It's these conditions called persistent weak layers that we've talked about a little bit, where your potential for producing really large avalanches goes up. Mm-hmm. And so whenever you're dealing with deeper avalanches and wider propagation, the chance for being fully buried goes up because you just have more debris. And so, yeah, that's why it was kind of more of an accident investigation, because we were wanted to kind of communicate to the public the potential for that weak layer and the potential for future avalanches on that weak layer. So,
Elliot, yes.
Yeah, I feel like for these deep, you know, the situation like that, it's harder and harder as it gets buried deeper, the weak part gets buried deeper, to get that feedback where, you know, it's where it's actually dangerous. So, you know, less likely it's going to happen. Bigger consequences. You'll see people ski on stuff all the time, and you start to get this idea like, oh, it's probably a good thing to go skiing right now because like other people are getting after it and it's fine. But then, you know, just one incident like this where somebody hits that little tiny spot, and then, you know, it all goes. And
yeah,
it's challenging to predict, challenging to forecast for these guys. And yeah,
and I guess just to clarify, it's not always like that. You know, most years we have some kind of a persistent weak layer that for a part of the season, but this year we've had a persistent weak layer for basically the whole first couple months of the season. And so just to give people a little perspective, like it's not always like that.
A little dicier this year than usual.
Yeah.
The Alaska Avalanche Information Center website says there have been 11 fatalities between May of 2019 and October of 2021, that not just in South Central, but includes deaths near Haines, on Alaska, Denali National Park. That sounds like a high number. Is it?
It sounds like a high number to me. I don't actually know off the top of my head all those accident reports, but we do. In Alaska, we kind of have a combination of like avalanches during the mountaineering season, like when people are climbing on Denali in the Alaska Range and those kind of bigger mountain expeditions. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of tends to happen later in the season, and that's one subset of avalanche accidents that we have. And then, of course, during the midwinter, like now, we also have another whole cluster of avalanche accidents and conditions that can lead to accidents across the state. Yeah, do you know more about that?
2 years ago, there was a significant amount of fatalities in avalanche terrain throughout the country. I think a lot of that was driven by COVID and the amount of, you know, we couldn't be inside.
Inexperienced folks getting out.
Yeah, everybody wanted to get outside for good reason. I mean, it's a pretty fun thing to do. But yeah, there's a lot more inexperienced people and just the push to be outside more because we couldn't do other stuff. So that was one contributing factor in the last couple of years. And then, I guess the amount of fatalities has not kept pace with the amount of users increasing. So the trend is generally better right now.
That's good.
And I don't know, we can pat ourselves on the back as educators and forecasters and saying we're doing a better job, but I don't know exactly what the reason is why that is happening.
I'm sure that's all part of it.
Yeah.
It has to have an effect on people's knowledge and safety. In our final minute here, what do you think the next decade will bring in terms of people, the number of people, and what type of activity they'll be engaged in for these wild areas? Elliot, as a guide, what are you seeing?
Just in terms of general trend, you mean?
Yeah.
I see more people in the backcountry. Our avalanche classes that we teach through the Alaska Guide Collective are pretty much always full. And, you know, we can only teach so many of those. So we're happy to see that there's so many other avalanche education providers in the field in Alaska and throughout the U.S. As more and more people learn that sliding down snow on snowy mountains is really fun, I think we're going to see more folks. And, you know, Alaska is a huge state. So it just, you know, as it gets more densely populated with recreators in some areas, I think we'll push out to more zones and explore more spots. But I think it's a pretty good future for this activity.
All right. What are you seeing, John?
Yeah, I guess I agree. I hope there's more people, and I hope that developments in the avalanche forecast and our ability to provide people with information products to help choose terrain that's appropriate for what the risk level that they're trying to get will allow people with less experience to still get into the backcountry. So you don't necessarily have to be getting out there all the time or super experienced to just go out and enjoy the mountains. And so I hope that the kind of demographic might shift towards a larger group of more novice users where we can provide them with like, hey, here's a bunch of safe places to go. You know, like just get out there and enjoy it and experience the conditions. And so that's kind of my hope.
And hopefully more access for folks who experience disabilities to be able to get out there. I know I was walking last night and thought, boy, if you had a wheelchair, you would not be going anywhere right now. So opportunities for folks that have mobility challenges are important too. How many days is the avalanche course itself? What kind of time commitment do people need to make?
You know, we do everything from 1 day rescue courses to 4 day recreational courses that, you know, it's worth your time in the long run.
All right. So 1 to 4 days, not a whole lot of time to commit to saving your life when you're in the backcountry. Thanks so much to my guests, Elliot Gaddy and John Sykes. Our engineer is Chris Hyde. Our producer is Madeline Rose. And on the phones and social media today, Michael Finelli helped us out. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening today. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.